Welcome to Vital Presence. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and we have a great lineup for you for season 5. I'm talking to people who are shaping the stories that are shaping today's world, showing us how we can all live more creatively at any age, but especially as we age. So I hope you enjoy, and then come on over to vitalpresence.com where you'll see some more information on the show notes. Well, I'm really looking forward to bringing you today's interview. My guest is Debbie Weiss, and she has a lot to say about transitioning in midlife. She's the author of Available As Is, A Midwife Widow's Search for Love. Came out this fall, I think. Is that right, Debbie? From She Writes Press. And I read it. I love it. It's gripping. It's well-written, but it's also a view into modern life that you really don't get in many places. I mean, what is it really like to be a widow? And then, oh my God, what is it really like to start dating again and rebuild your life at age 50? It's the kind of thing that a lot of us, we hope we'll never have to face it. You know, I'm a good deal older right now, but I still go, oh my God, you know, the day that I lose my husband, what am I going to do? And to have somebody who's so honest and available in sharing what it's really been like is really a great gift. And I know that you've shared your writing with the Modern Love column at New York Times. I mean, that's very prestigious. So congratulations. Yeah. And HuffPost, Women's Day, Reader's Digest, and other publications. And what's really cool about Debbie is that she's a former lawyer, but I think right now her identity is as a writer and a really good writer. And she's proud of earning her MFA in creative writing at age 56, which must have been really cool. We could talk about that because going back to school and completing a degree after you're 50. Why don't we start with your writing life? When did you start writing Available As Is?
Well, you know, Sally, at the beginning, I wasn't sure I was writing a book. After my husband passed, I went back to an adult education writing class I'd been taking. It's a weekly class. And about 2015, he passed in 2013. So about, you know, maybe 2014, 2015, I just started to write vignettes of things I was experiencing. And then in about 2017, I decided to try to put some of that together in a book.
And had you been shipping it off to your essays and columns to publications before you went forward with the book?
I had been, yes, I had. I was a HuffPost blogger in 2015, and I also wrote for kind of it was a funny group, sort of a feed that submitted articles to the Hearst magazines, Good Housekeeping, Women's Day. And I started to do that, I believe, in 2015. And as a new author, I got 8 articles published in those magazines. And I submitted some other places. And that encouraged me to keep going.
Super impressive, especially for a not yet known writer to be able to get in known publications like that. I saw that you used to have the moniker, the Hungover Widow. What's with that? And how did you choose that one?
Well, initially, that's in the book. When my husband passed, I drank a lot. And I drank in the evenings alone. And I was drinking Manhattans. That was my drink of choice at the time. So that was part of it. But I also felt like there was kind of an image of widows that was kind of either state, you know, it was very sort of staid and proper and kind of virtuous. And I wanted to mess with that. I liked the idea of admitting that, you know, when you're newly widowed, you're a little messed up. So hence the Hungover Widow.
I think that's a door opener for a lot of people who are widows or no widows and want to know what's real. So I applaud it, but it's also pretty, it's a pretty gutsy title, Hungover Widow. No, it's not all prettied up or anything. What is the storyline connotation around widows? And do you think it's changing at all?
To me, it feels like there's kind of two images of widows. You know, the one is the very traditional, the older woman who's a widow, who's wearing black and had a long life with her husband, and he didn't die terribly prematurely. This is a woman, you know, maybe in her 80s or something. And, you know, she's an appropriate good person. And then there are maybe some younger widows. And then there's sort of the odd 1950s stereotype where you see the widow with the tight black dress and the slit, you know, and the merry widow, I guess. But I mean, for every widow, there's a different individual. You can't group us. Our stories are also different. How we came to be widows is so different. And I also feel, like your podcast, that there's much more kind of normalizing and, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Supporting women in midlife. So I do think the image is changing that, you know, the woman in line next to you at the grocery store can easily be a widow. The woman next to me in yoga is a widow. We're everywhere.
Everywhere. But you know, I always find it so interesting to think about what are the stories and the connotations that go with different groups. I mean, I'm post midlife, you know, and so I get to laugh at all the connotations around aging, you know, just all the stories that set you up to see it in a particular way. So I was just thinking, okay, widow, what would I say? Oh, he's dating a widow. And what would come up? Well, oh, poor woman, she's a widow. You know, that could be one. Or, huh, I wonder if she's out for his money. She's a widow. You know, or what is he, you know, or he's a little younger. What do you think she's after? I mean, all of those really disgustingly
yes.
disrespectful, but out there in the story. And I say them because I think it's important to call them for what they are. You know, to be able to say, these are the stories that are out there, and we really have to blast through them, call them for what they are, and then give some alternatives that humanize people, always humanize.
I agree completely because, you know, it's been pretty rare, but occasionally, you know, I've been to something and I've been by myself and I've gotten a feeling when I'm introduced, you know, someone says, oh, it's your husband. Well, he died, you know, oh, you're single. Well, I'm widowed. And some sort of grabbing their husband a little bit, like get away from her. She, you know, she's looking for the next one. Or, you know, the idea of a widow that, you know, once you're widowed, your life is sort of over, which is also not good. So I do wish it would be kind of just kind of normalize it and just view this as a piece of life. I mean, I go to a yoga studio and so many women there have, you know, if they aren't widowed, they have widowed friends.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, when you think about it, it used to be that divorcee was a terrible word. And yes. Now, you know, one out of every two people you know has been divorced after a certain age. So it's like, you know, you're divorced. How many times have you been married? You know, it's not like a deal. But I think widow has been held as a little bit rarefied. So you probably got some advice. What was the worst advice you got when you were widowed?
Just be really cheerful. You know, people don't want to know that you're sad. People don't want to know that you're struggling. People want to know that you're over it, that you've recovered, that you're moving on, that you're in a new place. You know, when I was newly widowed, I did join some social groups in an effort to get out of the house, and people's always response was, you're over it. Well, you're never over it. So I feel like the worst advice is kind of this sense of just get over it, just move on. You know, we don't like to deal with grief. We don't like to deal with sadness. People are uncomfortable dealing with unhappy people.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, I've written a little bit about grief, and there was a fabulous book that I reviewed. I can't remember the name of it right now, but on sort of the American way of grief, which is basically that we don't get it. And we cause each other a lot of damage with attitudes like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear you talk about it. Just get over it, put on a happy face, move on, or let's pretend it never happened, you know, whatever it is. And all of those are really life constricting.
Very much, very much. I mean, you can be sad about it sometimes and still function very well and do well socially and be very upbeat at times, but this is still a piece. And I think all of us past a certain age have had losses, be it parents or siblings or another kind of loss. And it would be nice to be able to acknowledge and talk about losses and grief as part of a normal conversation. You use the word rarefied as opposed to something that's rarefied and somewhat shameful, as if it's terrible to admit that, God forbid, you're a little bit sad about something, or you have regrets, or you miss somebody. But that's so normal.
And I have a theory, which is totally unproven, but I think we all carry a lot of grief. I mean, look at the world today. Who wouldn't have grief living in this world with an open heart? And it's difficult for some of us to deal with our grief. So when we're in the face of somebody whose grief puts it in, you know, puts it right here, right in front of our eyes, we may not feel ready to deal with the thing that we're trying to avoid in us.
That's true. That's a really good point. You're right. I mean, if you see somebody, you know, I agree completely. There's someone who's grieving, they're sad, they've pushed it away. And if they see somebody who's more open about it, it's hard. You know, being a widow is hard because sometimes people see you and you're kind of the embodiment of their worst fears. It was odd for me when I would meet people and I was trying to be really unwidowy, whatever that is. I was trying not to be widowy. But, you know, I had lost my husband. And the first thing people goes, oh, my God, I could never deal with that. That's my worst fear. How did you cope? I would just die if that happened. And it's like it's this bizarre thing, but it's so very common.
You said on one of your blog posts, I think, that some of the worst widowing advice I received was the demand that I change. And you went on to talk about the importance of taking small steps that fit you instead of trying to do dramatic gestures that somebody else thinks might be good for you. Can you say a little more about that?
Oh, I'd love to. I'm a very cautious person. I am a former attorney, as you mentioned, that tends to go with caution. My mom died when I was 10, which also left me a very cautious person because I knew real young that, you know, if you let somebody out of your sight, they might vanish, you know. Kind of magical thinking there, but that's it's an odd thing for a 10-year-old. Although again, probably very common. So when I lost my husband, I don't have children. People were like, especially men seem to be like, well, you can do whatever you want. This is obviously divorced men who are trying to avoid their obligations. And it would be like, you know, travel. I would travel. I'd go to an ashram. You know, why don't you do this? You know, the whole eat, pray, love kind of thing. I would, you know, why don't you move? Why don't you do this? And it was like, well, for one thing, I know there's the trope, you don't do anything for a year. But I mean, I certainly wasn't in a state to make any major decisions. And at that point, I don't think I could have navigated an international airport. And for me, being a cautious person and trying to do things and create real change, for me, I had to take little steps forward. You know, starting with, okay, I'll redecorate. Then it's like, well, I still feel kind of closed in. So I'll make this major change to the house. Okay, this isn't enough. So I'm going to join a writing class and then, you know, a group and then maybe a writing retreat when I've never gone to something overnight, you know, things on my own because I'd always go to things with my husband. I didn't, you know, take things, writing or yoga or things so seriously. So for me, it was a matter of taking steps and saying, okay, this is okay. You can go further. You can do more. But I couldn't just do something major at the start.
That makes so much sense. And it also, it's a kind of guidance that doesn't seem real grounded in the invitation to really listen deeply to what calls you at any particular moment in time. It's somebody else giving you advice from out there, you know, some big thing that they think, instead of saying, hey, what's up for you? What is the right next step for you? And if it's a huge one, bully, you know, go do it. But if it's, you know, move the pillows on the sofa, it's move the pillows on the sofa. And I think that we don't always encourage people to do the inner listening that I think is really important.
I agree. I think sometimes we encourage people, we want to see big results. We want it to be like a movie, a rom-com, right? If this were a movie, the husband dies and 2 hours later, she's with somebody new living in an entirely different country, usually, probably, you know, preferably a count with a vineyard who was moonlighting as a server somewhere. But in real life, life isn't like that. You have to, you know, people have to do what they can do. And, you know, obviously if you're new, you know, new, suffered a loss, you need to do what's comfortable for you. You're not maybe at your peak place. And it helps to someone listen, what would be helpful. you know, for me, what was helpful, you know, if someone said, oh, why don't you go travel the world? It wasn't helpful. What was helpful was, would you like to go for lunch at a local restaurant? That's helpful.
Yeah, I hear you. For somebody who is, you'd call yourself introverted, is that fair? And
yes.
Yeah, introverted and cautious with this legal background. Jumping into online dating, which for me would look like a huge leap. It would actually personally be terrifying. And yet you did it. So how did that qualify as a small step?
Well, it was 14 months after my loss that I started. So it'd been over a year and I was very lonely. And, you know, you can make friends, and I'd made some by then, not so much, but you know, every evening alone was dreary. I had insomnia. So I actually went online. It's true. I look in the book at 4 a.m. And I joined JDate, which is a much smaller site, and it's aimed at Jewish people. I'm Jewish, not religious, but I figured I might. It was a smaller site. It seemed tamer. It seemed more manageable. I was probably falling into my own stereotypes, hoping that maybe the folks on this site were a little tamer than others. And they were, for the most part. You had more people, I think, who maybe wanted commitment, or at least said they did. So I started small with one site, and then there weren't really enough people on the site in my area to be worth it. And then I, you know, I got to some bigger sites, but I kind of started one
I
a little
see.
Small.
Well, your whole depiction of the getting back into dating was fascinating. And I think my eyes were bulging at times thinking, oh my God, are these Cretans out there? I mean, how do you meet so many seemingly interesting on the surface guys who turn out to be completely self-absorbed, looking for a caretaker, an assistant, a house sitter, whatever it might be, you know, a sex when I want it kind of guy. Is that truly the world of online dating, or did you just have a unlucky streak?
Well, I'll tell you two things. I mean, I've got a few, several, I could go on for like the whole hour about
yeah,
this.
I get that.
But to try to give you a few pieces of this, for one thing, I think when we get into our generation, I'm going to be 60. When I lost my husband, I was 50. Women were raised to provide sort of the emotional labor. Men were raised, you know, they were not to be maybe so in touch with their emotions, but if so, they dump it on a woman. When you were listing the things that people wanted from me, I would say de facto therapist was the biggest. People, you know, guys would kind of want to dump their agony, their exes, their misery. Which secretly I didn't have a lot of sympathy for, because I'd seen someone through cancer and these guys were wimpy to me. You know, they really, you know. And the other issue I think is, and my dad talked about this too, because, you know, he started dating when he was 42. That was in the mid to 1970s, because, you know, again, my mom. So one of the things I think happens, and I'll give you an analogy. When people talk about the California bar exam, they say it's really hard. It has a 45 or 50% pass rate. At least it did when I took it. But first time takers, it's a 70%. So the odds are really low because people keep retaking it. The people who flunk it more than once are more likely to flunk it a second, a third, and then you get your terrible statistics. Those of us who went to a good school, took it first time, 80% pass rate. And I think that's a lot. I think that translates to midlife singles, because emotionally with it, midlife singles are married or partnered in some way at the 60s, or, you know, they're married or they're partnered or they're in happy polyamorous relationships, but they're in the relationship they want, or they're in a long-term relationship. Like, I would still be with George if he hadn't died. So I think this gets really crazy because you have a lot of folks who are messed up and they're forming the dating pool because they're not getting picked up. They're not leaving it. They're not passing the bar. They're not moving into long-term relationships. They're like fish. They're, you know, they're being caught and released repeatedly. So, you know, this is what you've got. This is your released fish problem.
That is just the best image. Oh my God, you know. and the parallel, the statistical parallel with the Bar Association is really interesting. So it's not like there aren't good men or good women in the pool. It's the good ones get, you know, they go off somewhere else, and you're left with this pool of less appealing, although they may, it sounded like your guys were often attractive on some level.
In some way, yeah. I think that's
but,
true.
But not so soul attractive, you know?
No, they didn't. They looked good on the surface, and underneath, you know, it was rotten fish, right?
One of the gifts that you gave in your book was describing the longer term relationship you had with somebody who I would call abusive.
He was.
Yeah. And it's good to be able to see that somebody who is feet on the ground, a really smart, attractive woman, when she's going through a lot, can still be subject to abuse. You know, we like to think, oh, I would never let myself be abused. Well, honey, you might. Under certain circumstances, you might. And so did you know you were being abused in that relationship? Would you have used those words, or was it more in retrospect that you could have?
It was more in retrospect. You know, at the time, I didn't really see this as that. I saw it as disagreements, but eventually I did see it as abuse, the controlling, the not being left alone, being, you know, I felt being, you know, being closed in. I saw it later, the unpleasantness, the changes in attitude. The minute you're like, oh, I'm gone, suddenly, oh, but I can't live without you, you know, which I think is a very typical thing for abusers and is sometimes hard for women who are raised to be nice girls because we don't want to hurt people. And yeah. We're supposed to help.
Well, you had a really gripping scene where you were getting in your car, trying to drive away, said person blocks you in the parking area and isn't going to let you go. And fortunately, there was somebody who came, you know, was there noticing the scene and said, you are going to let her go, and, or you're going to go to, you know, or I'm calling the cops right now. And he starts saying something, but she's my girlfriend and we're just having a little, you know, a little conversation. And
that's shocking.
That was shocking. It was like, oh my gosh. And then also to have the interplay, just to know that somebody is still trying to play the scene. Like, oh, it's not so bad. We're just having an argument.
That was horrific. I mean, that was a real wake up call to me because I've been raised not to draw attention to myself, to live a quiet life. You know, and my life was like that. I'm usually the, you know, my husband and I were quiet people. And to suddenly be in the middle of this kind of thing that was public and thinking, oh God, I've got to call 911, which I also had to do on this guy to get him out of my house. I mean, he just kept coming over when it wasn't, I told him, you are not welcome. Don't come here. I finally had to call the police. I mean, suddenly I had turned into this vision of, you know, can I get on the Jerry Springer show now? You know, I mean, it wasn't how I was raised. It felt, there was an element of shame because it felt very trashy. And I felt very ashamed that I'd let myself get into that situation. And, you know, this was also somebody who really didn't have much remorse.
Yeah.
You know, you can't argue with an abusive person. I did some research into it and started to understand it a bit better. They don't listen to reason. They have their vision. And it's not a view that, or a vision that most people would share.
Yeah. And at the same time, when you have cared about someone, to basically call the cops and ask them to be locked up is a big deal, because you, there's probably a voice that's also going, well, you know, I don't want him to get hurt, you know, or this part of him is trying to be better, or whatever the script is. It's a deal to do something that could potentially hurt somebody that you've cared about, even though he totally deserves it.
You know, by the time I called the police, I really wanted him gone. He had behaved dangerously in driving situations where we'd been together. It's in the book. I thought he was dangerous, and he was druggy by that point. He wasn't when we first got together. You know, he was on different kinds of medications, and he was combining some drugs. And I'd had enough problems with him that by the time I called the police, it was just like, get out of my life. You know, I had told him repeatedly, you aren't welcome. Don't come to my house. in my view, you've endangered my life. And again, that's the kind of thing where, you know, people like that don't have they don't live in reality.
Yeah.
They're not in reality.
What advice would you give to somebody who's just going back into online dating midlife to avoid those kinds of people?
Yeah. It's funny. I actually wrote something about that recently. It's in a publication called Next Avenue.
Oh, good. Well, I can link to it in the show notes. So that would be interesting.
That would be great.
Yeah.
It's not about avoiding abuse, but it was kind of about what to do when you're dating post widowhood. And one of the first pieces of advice I had is don't date until you found yourself. Because like for me, I was with my late husband since I was 17. I'd known him since I was 7. When he died, I was 49, almost 50. So I'd grown up with him. I was half a couple for most of my life. And I had to create a self and figure out what I like to do as an individual, as a potentially single person, you know, someone on their own. And so my advice for one thing is don't do this until you've gotten yourself straightened out. I had a lot of guilt over my husband's death. And I think part of that resulted in my being with this guy because I thought, well, maybe I don't deserve such a good life. I didn't see a great future then. I wasn't seeing myself having that much of a future. So I think the first thing to do is really get yourself in place and what you like and how you want to be. And then I think it's easier to say, well, this doesn't, you can say, well, this is, you know, you can see that that's not good because you have enough self-esteem and enough of your own depth at that point.
That's great. Great advice. Great for everything. And it was also, it made me happy at the end of your book that even though you were in your last chapter, you're hiking with a man who sounds like a very nice guy. You're not putting the rom-com twist on it. It's not like I found the guy and so now my life is okay. You more felt like Debbie's found her marching legs. You know, she's solid on her own feet. And incidentally, she can relate to men or this particular person from that place. But it wasn't the same as a rom-com ending.
No, it couldn't be. I had an editor for the book, a woman who is a very established author. And, you know, one of the things we talked about is the book has to end with this person looking like they're going to be okay on their own. You know, the narrator is going to have to be okay on her own. The point was that it's not that there's another man who's going to step in and then she's going to be half a couple again. She has to be able to function on her own and find some joy in life and some inner depth and some inner resources and her own passions. I think that's really important. You know, and most married people probably already knew that. I was in a very all-encompassing marriage. And again, I was, you know, since I was 16. So I let, and then, you know, law school and my work was pretty intense until I was 40 and I retired. So I really hadn't kind of worked on, well, what do I like to do? You know, if I wake up in the morning and I'm on my own, what would bring me joy and feed my soul enough that I have inner resources?
One of the themes in the book, like a sub theme to me, was the changing nature of your relationship with George, the husband. Because in the beginning, the mood that I would have given it was like just loss, just the grief for the, you know, soulmate, the love of your life who's no longer there. And yet around mid book, there were other themes coming through, like he really should have let us talk about his dying. He really should have let me go public. We really needed to think things through. My life would have been a lot easier if he hadn't had his, been a bit bullheaded about some of the things that he wanted around the end of life. And so your relationship became more complex in a certain way.
Yeah, you're right. When he was gone, it became more complex when he was gone. You're absolutely right. And that was another thing I worked through with my editor because with the first draft of the book and I revised it once and I thought, this is pretty good. I'm going through my list. And I hand it to her and she says, well, you've missed the point. She said, you've idealized your marriage so much. And that's not, it doesn't feel real. and it's not honest. And I had to look back at that and see that, you know, I'd really catered. I mean, I'd organized my life around George, not his fault. It was just what I did. That was me. And there were things I'd wanted to do that he really hadn't. And I hadn't really had a voice to say, but I want to travel, or, but I want to take my writing seriously, or I want to go to this writing retreat. I hadn't done any of that. And when I was trying to put a life together on my own, I realized there was a lot more I could have done when I was married. I just didn't think to.
I really appreciate that you made it more complex. And I think it also is one of the things that will make your book helpful to people, especially helpful to widows, because our emotions are incredibly complex. We can, you know, be tragically sad and grieving about someone and also pissed at them.
Yeah.
And it all goes together. We can be happy to be not with them one moment and then have the bottom drop out and miss them like all heck. You know, we can have it all, but sometimes that complexity gets missed in the, you know, the top storyline.
I agree. It's like a TV show, you know, the rom-com thing. Again, you know, you see the people are so simplified, which is fair. I mean, it's a TV show, but yeah, I didn't want the book. It was a lot longer than a 2-hour Lifetime movie. So yeah, I wanted it to feel honest. And I think probably a lot of us, especially women, do make compromises in long marriages or long relationships, right? I mean, and we do get very much maybe influenced by the people we're with. So, you know, I think it's true. You know, there's good parts and bad parts, right? This is super loving. But when I've talked about my marriage to some people, they've said, oh, that's kind of stifling.
You talked about working with your editor, who sounded like she gave you a really good piece of advice. How did writing your memoir change you, if it did?
Well, probably made me more serious. Because this was really a lot of work. You know, again, I'm a former lawyer. I was an English major, but then, you know, I practiced law till I was 40. And my original writing isn't good. It is, in fact, it's bad. If you look at my early blog posts, they were just more like, this guy was a real jerk, and this is what he said. There's no nuance. There's nothing. There's just like a little vignette of, oh my God. And you know, the writing, if you're writing a whole book, you have to add nuance. My favorite books are books without villains. They're with real people where everybody has good parts and bad parts. They have masculine energy, feminine energy. They have different pieces of themselves. They're great in some situations and they're awful in others. And I had to dig into all that and I had to structure the book. The book took a lot of structuring and then getting the MFA. So by the time I was done, I'm pretty serious. You know, I've taught some writing classes by now. And so I would say it's made me like a more serious kind of writer. You know, I mean, I think it's fun and I don't know that I'd write another book like this again, but it did make me much more kind of serious and I could analyze craft and all this stuff with the MFA. I can use words like interiority.
Oh, that's good. I don't think I've earned that right yet. A year plus ago, you wrote about, you were anticipating promoting your book, but you were feeling hesitant about it. And you wrote, and now I'd almost rather let it go than promote it. Somehow getting it published was a dream, but pushing it on people just feels wrong. Has that changed?
Oh, goodness. Well, again, that's another answer. I could just go on forever, but let's try this. I think there's like 4 million books published a year. It's very hard in some ways if you don't have a traditional publisher or you're not a known author. I won't even say the traditional publisher is the issue. I think it's being an unknown author. People aren't really interested in unknown authors. It's real, you know, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I reached out to the local, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle a bunch of times. I reached out to a few, you know, local things a bunch of times. The publication that's been kind and put in a lovely review is the Benicia magazine here where I live in my lovely small town. But it's extraordinarily difficult to get any attention as an unknown author, at least for me. Maybe other people are better at this. I don't know. You know, I hired a traditional publicist and nothing happened, except, you know, my bank account is a little lighter. So,
and yet you've done a whole host of you've done a video blog, and you've done a lot of podcasts and all. So I would going to your website, say you've been out there. I was contrasting these two worlds of the woman who said, I don't want to promote, and the woman who's been prolific in sharing her wisdom with the public around, you know, widowhood, the new dating transitions, and your book, you know.
Well, thank you. What I kind of looked at was what was working and what do I like to do? And I love talking to people. I mean, like what we're doing now, I love this. This isn't promotion. This is just fun. And if it's helping somebody, better. So I just kind of looked at what do I like to do? And I'm happy to reach out to podcasts. I'm actually pretty good at, again, former lawyer, the cover letter thing. I'm real good at writing letters that are kind of tailored to different individuals and saying, well, what's helpful? And, you know, I'm pretty gung-ho. I'm doing a podcast next month with a young male guy who looks at entrepreneurial issues. I don't see myself that way, but it would be nice to, you know, I just kind of looked at what could I do on my own and reaching out to different folks who have done, you know, Instagram lives or a podcast here or a YouTube there is something I love to do. So for me, I'm probably coming up by the time next month, like 35 or 40 podcasts and interviews. But to me, it's a pleasure. And, you know, publicists, I guess, I don't know that they go for things that aren't necessarily big, big famous stuff. So for me, it's fun to find something that looks interesting or see what other folks are doing that looks fun and giving it a try. You know, I put something out in Next Avenue. I have something coming up again in HuffPost Personals. I have something coming there. And some of it, what you don't see is it's frustrating because a lot of people just don't answer you. You know, right now I'm trying to figure out how to send a book to England because I'm trying to deal with podcasts there. But for me, it was changing it from sort of pushing the book to, well, what experiences do I enjoy? And realizing that what I love is talking to people.
Well, there's a lot of wisdom in what you're saying, Debbie. And I think, I'm sure some of the people listening are thinking about writing a book or they're going to write a book, and many of them may be midlife. So the first thing is that to know you can publish your first book in your mid 50s, or you're almost 60 right now. Is that it? Or you are 60, but anyway, so to be at that threshold and feel like you got your MFA at 56, go girl, you know, that's so exciting. And then at the same time, to be able to say, it's kind of like what we were talking with widowhood, you have to find the path that's right for you. And so there's so much hype about how you're supposed to promote yourself, how you're supposed to publicize your book. And then you go, hey, you're almost 60. Don't you get to do it your own way? You know, don't you get to say, what's going to be life-giving to me? What do I like doing? What am I good at? What's my strength? And really steering on that, rather than just going downstream on the current of, you know, what everybody else thinks you should do.
I feel that way strongly. I mean, like, I didn't mind doing some videos. I'm on TikTok. I have very few followers, but I've read my book. I've done a couple funny pieces on like dating at 50. I need to do more. But it's kind of, you know, one thing about being midlife, you know, I'm almost 60. I don't care if I don't come across great. I'll be honest. You know, I did a reading at my local synagogue and chatted with the rabbi. It was amazing. And someone said in the audience, you said you have anxiety, which I do, but you're not nervous. You're right. I'm not. Because I'm older. I don't care. I've been through my 20s. I've been nervous when I was a lawyer in court. Like, oh my God. You know, at this point, it's fine. If you don't like, I mean, if someone doesn't care for what I'm talking about or I don't resonate with them, that's okay. You know, if my TikTok video looks stupid, I'll take it down, but you know, I'll give it a shot. But it is for me a matter of just trying to do a few things that I enjoy. You know, like a lot of people do, you know, there's a lot of the social media posting that's constant. I found a real hassle. I didn't feel that it led to book sales past a certain point or interest because, you know, you have your social media group. It's, I think it's very hard to become a quote unquote influencer or this huge thing. So for me, it was a matter of, am I helping people? And what can I kind of do that I think is fun? You know, meeting new people and chatting and occasionally doing something out of my comfort zone, you know, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can begin to wrap there because I think that is such good advice for people in the third act of life to be able to say, you know, for everything that we lose and all the grief that we may be feeling, there are things that really stand out as gifts. And one of them is just this place to say, you know, I do get anxious, but I don't have to be anxious about being anxious because really what the heck, you know, or I don't have to take everybody's advice. I can listen and pick those things that really mean something to me. I can go with what I know about myself and I can open up new doors as well. You know, I'm not stuck. I just don't have to do it in some big, tremendous, impress somebody else way. I just do it in a way that's really consistent for what I know is right for me. So you share about that in your book, but I think you're also modeling it in the path that you've taken, Debbie. So I really applaud that. And I hope people will really learn and take courage and take inspiration so that they can go and do the piece that's calling to them right now.
Very much. I think that's what's so important. One of my big themes in things I write these days is, you know, that it took a dramatic, you know, a devastating loss for me to change my life and reinvent myself, do things that I wanted to do, like travel, which my husband hadn't, or write a book, which I didn't put the effort in when I was married. But it shouldn't take a devastating loss to do the things that you love. You know, you can do them now. You know, and you can, you know, work within your relationship or whatever for that to happen, but very much to, you know, do the things that you love or follow the dreams that you have without needing a huge loss to throw them into relief.
That's beautiful wisdom. It's beautiful wisdom. And, you know, with that, you say, and you don't even have to wait until you're 50.
No, you don't.
But when you're 50 or 60 or 70, you know, for what I can speak, it's a good incentive to get going because at this point, you know, why are you waiting? You know, it doesn't make much sense anymore. So,
no, I agree. And I agree. You know, at some point it doesn't. And at some point there are some physical limitations. Yeah. There just are. You know, my dad's 92. He loved to travel, but that's not happening. But he did all that when he was younger. He looks back with great joy.
So beautiful. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking time. I'm so happy to know that you like doing podcasts because that comes across and it's totally fun to talk to you. And I invite people to go to the show notes for vitalpresence.com because I will include a link to your book, a link to your website, and to that Next Avenue article. If you give me the link to that, I'll put it out so people can see what other creative advice is coming through you these days. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. This is wonderful.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes. And then come on over to vitalpresence.com, where you can learn more about the show and also join our conversation about what it is to thrive and create at any age.